You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Barnett. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, on the day that the final report is published into the 2009 crash involving Air France flight A447, we'll be talking to aviation experts and analysts for their verdict on the accident. As the South Korean government follows in the controversial footsteps of its neighbour Japan, which allows whale hunting for research, we'll get the latest from our man in Seoul.
They want to learn things that non-lethal capture cannot teach. Of course, many environmental activists say this is guise for the resumption of commercial whaling.
What has the Higgs boson ever done for us? We'll be looking into what technology spin-offs have occurred as a result of the boson hunt. We'll also be looking up as London's tallest new landmark is unveiled, the Shard.
The lack of density from a vertical perspective in that area, it really sort of does cut through the landscape.
And we'll be hearing what you can expect from London's Literature Festival. All that plus, we'll play some music too, including a Midori House session from our archive. All to come in the next hour here on Monocle 24. First, let's catch up on the headlines with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Investigators probing the Air France Rio Paris crash that killed 228 people 3 years ago have blamed a combination of pilot error and faulty speed sensors. The final report, released today by the BEA, France's air accident investigator, recommended a series of actions on training and cockpit design to try to avoid a repeat of the disaster over the Atlantic that has pitted pilots and Air France against Airbus, the maker of the plane, over who was to blame. The Air France flight plunged from 38,000 feet into the Atlantic Ocean on June 1st, 2009, after a chaotic four-minute ordeal in which pilots battled a stall alarm emergency. Families of the crash victims said they were not entirely satisfied with the findings. Barbara Krald is the mother of one of those victims.
I can't be satisfied. I must say once again, I didn't read the report, and we will make analysis of this report. We have experts who will look at it. But at this moment, I only can say I hoped they would find other reasons as well, but they didn't occupy with technical reasons for the crash.
The French government has opened what it called a Syrian People's House in Paris to act as a gathering point for the opposition and émigré community opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, one day ahead of the opening of a major conference of powers that back his removal. Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius told reporters that Assad must be removed, while a senior member of the Syrian National Council opposition group said the peace plan of former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was mired in crisis. WikiLeaks says it has begun publishing more than 2 million emails from Syrian government officials that would embarrass not only Damascus, which is trying to crush a 16-month rebellion, but also its opponents. WikiLeaks spokeswoman Sarah Harrison told a news conference the emails were from Syrian political figures.
The Syria files shine a light on the inner workings of the Syrian government and economy, but they also reveal how the West and Western companies say one thing and do another. The range of information extends from the intimate correspondence of the most senior Ba'ath Party figures to records of financial transfers sent from Syrian ministries to other nations.
The news website says a general in the elite Syrian Republican Guards has defected to Turkey. It was the first such reported defection of a high-ranking military supporter of President Assad since the rebellion against him started. A pair of trucks carrying NATO supplies have crossed into Afghanistan. It's the first time in more than 7 months that Pakistan has allowed Western nations to use its roads to supply troops in Afghanistan. Customs officials said the container trucks had passed through the Shaman border crossing into southern Afghanistan, a milestone following a deal this week with the United States ending the impasse triggered by the killing of 24 Pakistani soldiers by US aircraft last November. In London, British police have arrested six people suspected of preparing terrorist attacks, some of them from near the Olympic site. A security source said the London arrests were related to international Islamist militancy and were made at an early stage of plotting. It wasn't clear if any targets were identified. Police said the six were arrested on suspicion of the commission, preparation or instigation of acts of terrorism. The European Central Bank cut interest rates to a record low today to breathe life into a deteriorating Eurozone economy, and backup measures agreed by government leaders last week to tackle the bloc's debt crisis. European shares extended gains on the news and the euro fell. And Europe's highest building will be officially inaugurated in just over 4 hours with a laser and light show. The Shard, which is close to London Bridge, stands 310 metres high. The ceremony takes place at 10:15 British summer time, when lasers and searchlights will be fired off to 15 other skyscrapers and landmarks. The Shard cost €560 million to build. Most of that money came from the Caffery royal family. Irvin Seller, the project's developer, says it really is something else.
I don't think there are, in fact, I'm sure there isn't another vertical town in Europe which comprises of retail, offices, restaurants, hotel. We've got the Shangri-La Hotel, apartments, and a viewing gallery. And it's also the first building privately to be open to the public.
And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Nick. It's 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett, on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 tag,
this is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
Tämä on Monocle
24. The Jalavet, Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Aftoimet on Monocle 24.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Now, on the 1st of June 2009, Air France flight AF447 crashed into the Atlantic during a storm while en route from Rio de Janeiro to Paris. All 228 passengers and crew lost their lives. On Thursday, the final report into the accident was published by the BEA, the French Aviation Authority. It lays the blame on malfunctioning speed sensors on the Airbus A330, as well as errors made by the plane's crew who lost control of the situation, according to the author. Airbus and Air France are at odds over who should take responsibility for the disaster, and victims' families are unhappy at what they perceive to be a failure to call the aerospace industry to account. To help us make sense of the report, we're joined by experts in aviation, flight safety, air travel and the industry in France. First up, we're crossing over to Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine. Hello, Murdo.
Hello.
What are the key lessons, then, to be learned from this report?
Well, I think, like a lot of crashes, I think the first thing to note is that accidents like this happen so rarely. So when they do, there's a lot of focus on the reasons for them. And this accident just seemed to be, there just almost seemed to be no reason for it. Obviously, we've got now the explanation from the investigators, and it's really a combination of the two things, you know, a malfunctioning, a technical malfunction, what are called the pitot tubes, failed to. To work as the aircraft went through a storm, and then what really then led to the fatal chain of events was the actions by the pilots, and you know, failing to notice that they were putting the aircraft into a situation where it stalled, and then even after that, you know, not being aware that they were in the process of stalling.
Okay, so. I mean, you've explained the reasoning, but are you surprised or concerned by the apparent disagreement between Airbus and Air France? And what responsibility, if any, should the French Aviation Authority be taking? Because that's the real question here.
Well, I think that in these sort of things, there's a really an inevitable split between it's always we're always very reluctant in this industry to use the word blame because accidents are the result of factors of things that happen, and I think blame is a very very difficult word to use.
But what responsibility and who should take it for people who know nothing about this industry?
I think the responsibility I think probably lies more with the actions of the pilots.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Now joining us is the Flight Safety Fund from the Flight Safety Foundation. Is their CEO Bill Voss? Hello, Bill.
Hello.
So, yeah. Bill, you believe that the industry has failed to recognise the implicit dangers of increased automation. Is the suggested failure, therefore, of the pilots here a consequence of this?
Yeah, well, it's certainly important in these sort of events, not just to point fingers to the pilots and say, well, bad pilots, and, well, they seem to have died, and it's a pity. That's the worst thing you can do after an accident. What you really have to do is focus on what the industry needs to do in response. Clearly, there has been a long trend of increasing reliance on the automation in aircraft, which is inevitable, but we really haven't done much about it as an industry, and I have to say that's globally. It's not an Airbus, it's not an Air France issue, it's an industry issue. We've been slow to respond to something that's been not very subtle, and here we finally have an accident that crystallizes us and pushes us into action.
Do you believe they're going to make the necessary changes? For instance, will we see pilot training reformed as a result of this?
I know that before the report even came out, there were airlines around the world, many, launching into specialized training programs. They weren't waiting to hear the report. They were already doing it. In addition, there's a task force been established in the international regulatory level that's looking at this aggressively. And I think if you want real justice, you don't worry about so much who's to blame, but you make sure that the industry steps forward and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Okay, thank you very much. That's Bill Voss, the CEO of the Flight Safety Foundation. And now we cross over to regular flyer, Monocle's Bruce Leishman, for the passenger point of view. Hi, Bruce.
Emma, hi.
What do you make of today's furore? Does this explain this report now, why people care about who they fly with?
Yeah, look, I think it does, because I think that, you know, very much does point finally to the very human elements, you know, in this tragedy and in the events. You know, I think it does very much point to that, you know, that element of training and, you know, in this era of push flying, you know, push button flying, there does need to be, you know, that additional element of training to, you know, to come into effect when, you know, when the push button flying strays off course.
Bruce, when you make your travel plans, and we know that you are a frequent flyer, are your plans affected by safety records and reports? How much do you check that out? Or are you more concerned with the customer experience you get from that airline?
Look, I'm not terribly concerned with safety myself, but I still think if we do look at the statistics, we're generally going to be pretty much okay. And who would ever thought that it would be Air France that would drop out of the sky? You know, I'm in Kiev, you know, at the moment, and I'm always looking at these errors fit Boeing 767s from about 20 years ago taking off to fly over the Atlantic to New York, and I wonder how on earth they make it all that way. But yet they do. So, you know, I think it's difficult to judge. I was coming back last night on a red eye from Dubai to Vienna, which was operated by Lufthansa, and, you know, there was at one point I woke up during the night and the plane was kind of making these shaking sounds, and there was a bit of shudder going on. But, you know, being on Lufthansa, you know, I've brought their PR slant, which they release every few months about their flying schools in Germany and Arizona. And, you know, I did, you know, go back to sleep immediately, fairly well assured that, you know, the plane's in capable hands.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that insight. That was Monocle's Bruce Leishman. And now we're going to get the reaction from Paris. This is Monocle's correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson.
Today, it's technical failure and human error. That's what's being blamed for the June 2009 crash. The French Aviation Authority, the BEA, said it was a chain of disastrous events. The fact that the plane went down at night in a thunderstorm, during which time the pilots only had split seconds to make decisions that were based on deceptive information. And that was coming from their controls, because the reports very much mentioned this question of faulty speed sensors. But it's nothing new. It was actually one of the first theories that was put forward immediately after the crash. And what's really angering people here in France as much today as 3 years ago, that's when the theory was first put forward, is the fact that faulty speed sensors were already a known problem. The French manufacturer, Thales, they've all been removed, those particular types of speed sensors from commercial aviation, from aircraft. But the fact that even before the AF447 crash, their reliability had been called into question, many people have been asking, why did it take a fatal plane crash for the problem to be actually dealt with? Now, several areas have been identified for improvement in that report: systems, training, procedures. And for the victims' families, possibly some comfort, they were there waiting at the Aviation Authority's offices, which are on the outskirts of Paris, and they were given a briefing ahead of today's public release of that report. But the president of the Victims' Family Association said that they've grown very impatient. It's taken 3 years to reach this point, and not everyone's buying those human error arguments that were in the report. There are concerns that, given that both the two main companies in this problem are French and they're powerful companies, many people are asking whether their clout perhaps played some sort of a part into the probe, into the causes for that disaster. And some victims' family members are saying that the report didn't place enough focus on the technical aspects of the problems that led to the crash. Well, shortly after today's report was published, Air France issued a statement. It paid a tribute to the courage of the pilots and the other crew members and the passengers who lost their life. Very briefly, looking at some of the online reaction to today's report, the comments at the bottom of articles on the websites of major French dailies, there's some fairly recurrent themes emerging even within minutes of the articles being published, and as well as expressing sympathy for the victims. For example, a reaction on the website of Le Parisien, one person says, "Why is it so difficult to prosecute an airline?" Another one says, "3 years to tell us it's human and technical error." And another one says, "How about looking a little harder at the plane manufacturer?" Well, this Thursday's report is by no means the end of the matter. The finger pointing between Airbus and Air France continues over just who's to blame. French magistrates are investigating both companies for alleged manslaughter, and the findings of that inquiry are expected next week.
That was Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson. You're listening to Midori House.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett. Now, what has Higgs boson ever done for me? This might be a phrase you'd mutter to yourself as you try to understand the complexity of the so-called God particle that gives matter mass and holds the physical fabric of the universe together. At an estimated cost of £4 billion for the 20 member countries who have invested, including debt-hit Greece, Spain and Portugal, it hasn't been a cheap study. But other world-changing discoveries and creations have come from the boson hunt. Probably the most significant is the World Wide Web, created in 1989 by Tim Berners-Lee. The construction of the technology required to smash atoms together at close to the speed of light has led to other advances in medical imaging, superconductivity, radiation therapy for cancer treatment, and advanced machinery. So, to talk us through Boson's biggest spin-offs and what might still be to come, we're joined on the line by science journalist David Whitehouse. Hello, David.
Hello.
So, Higgs boson has dominated the headlines this week. Is it fair to say that there are often spin-offs when it comes to high-tech research?
There are, but certainly you don't go into high-tech research to get the spin-offs. The spin-offs come, and you know they'll come, as a result of pursuing a goal of understanding nature at the deepest level. So on the one hand, you have to look at the billions of pounds spent to try and find the Higgs boson and explore the universe's building blocks as curiosity, as research into why we're here, how we're here, what this all means around us. But you know that even if you can't predict it, you know that along the line, as you develop the technology, as you develop the managerial skills, as your workforce develops high-tech skills that they move into other areas of industry, you know there are going to be other benefits as well as knowledge. Mm.
Do you agree that sometimes discoveries which don't seem very important at the time then turn into something quite crucial?
Well, yes, that's the whole thing about exploring the universe. You can't really tell what's going to spin off and what's going to be important, because the goal is to understand the bedrock of the universe, the laws, the particles that make up everything, and the Higgs boson is an important part of that jigsaw. And everything else that comes out of it is, if you like, a bonus. You can't look at this at the beginning and say you'll make a profit from it. Afterwards, when you add up what you discovered along the way, the tricks, the techniques, the technology that you can apply to other things, you can say, yes, okay, we will make a profit out of it. I think a good example is the landing on the moon. You know, what has the landing on the moon ever done for me? And that cost a major proportion of the American gross national product in the 1960s. Well, President Bush later said it was the best return on an investment since Leonardo da Vinci bought a sketch pad, because it fertilized American industry. It gave technologies of computing, of materials, of all types of industries benefited from it. And you've got a high-tech workforce. You've got a lot of people who were inspired to go into science and technology. And it generally improved the whole infrastructure and industry of the United States. So these things have many benefits, even though when you say, I want to find the Higgs boson, you can't say what those benefits are because you haven't found them yet.
Can you tell us, I mean, you've just obviously mentioned one there, but with specific reference to the CERN laboratory, which, you know, is very famous, but many people don't really realise what the other spin-offs to come out of it are. Could you maybe talk to a few of them?
Well, as you said, that World Wide Web came away from CERN, yep, because it was too expensive to fly scientists to the base from all around the world. So they had to find a way of connecting their computers to move vast amounts of data around so that they could analyse what they were doing wherever they were in the world. And out of that came the World Wide Web. And it's still, because the amount of data you get from these machines is still increasing. And in fact, the CERN's own internal network is like a mini World Wide Web of its own. They're still improving our understanding of transmitting data, of improving the internet, of improving all these things. Superconductivity, the materials and the magnets they use to steer these beams so they can collide at high energies, that is finding its way into all sorts of microelectronics, into all sorts of advanced computing. Indeed, the Chinese know this. This is why they're involved in many areas of high energy research and high tech research, because the managerial techniques you use, you develop to deal with high amount of data, technical, advanced, talented people, interfacing them with companies, with suppliers and contractors. All that involves new skills and new techniques that in fact, the car industry in Great Britain has learned from places like CERN in order to do this more efficiently. So you get benefits that weave themselves throughout the whole of society from CERN.
David, as a final question then, there are obviously some incredible discoveries happening because of high-tech research at the moment. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is inspiring a new generation of scientists and engineers?
Yes, I do. I think it always has done. the Apollo program inspired generations of people to go into technology, into astronomy. CERN does the same thing again. The space shuttle did the same thing again. I think we're having, you know, our world is ever increasingly technological, ever increasingly reliant on science. And I think a lot of people, when they're growing up, want to be a part of this. And they do so because they are inspired. And subsequently, they change the world.
Brilliant stuff. Thanks so much. That was science journalist David Whitehouse. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett, on Monocle 24. South Korea is considering hunting whales in the waters off its shores for what it says are scientific purposes, drawing criticism from anti-whaling countries and environmental activists. Some critics have argued that whales don't have to be killed to be studied, and the real motive behind the research is to provide meat. The South Korean government follows the controversial steps of its neighbour Japan, which allows hunts for research. A crack in the International Whaling Commission ban that permits hunting for such purposes. Japan's active whale expeditions have long drawn international criticism. A little earlier, Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards spoke with Jason Strother in the capital Seoul. He started by asking him to explain how the loophole is being exploited there.
So South Korea now is waiting for approval from the International Whaling Commission to be granted permission to conduct what they're calling scientific research, catching and killing whales around its territorial waters. They say they want to examine migration patterns, learn things that non-lethal capture cannot teach. But of course, many environmental activists abroad as well as here in South Korea say this is just disguise for the resumption of commercial whaling, which has been banned for about 25 years.
Now, is it not true that there's already some whales that are snared in commercial fishing nets that are then actually allowed to be sold to markets and restaurants in South Korea? So is there already some limited trade?
Already, if fishermen snag a whale in their fishing nets, if one washes up on shore, they are allowed to be auctioned off for meat and then sold in restaurants. Some fishermen evidently call this the lottery of the sea, catching one by chance in their nets. There are restaurants here in Seoul that serve whale, but it's much more common on the southwest coast, especially in the city of Ulsan, which kind of fancies itself as the hub of the whaling tradition here in South Korea. They have an annual whale festival where visitors are encouraged to go and patronize the local restaurants that serve whale on the menu. So it is available, but it's definitely not a cuisine that most Koreans eat.
Now, I wanted to ask you how much this reflects a cultural issue. Obviously, Japan breaks the moratorium with its scientific whaling. Other countries have a sort of a subsistence rule where if it's part of the heritage, you know, they get a dispensation. I think that happens in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. How much is this a cultural thing for South Korea about, you know, expressing that shared identity, that heritage of whale hunting?
Well, the South Korean delegation to the IWC said that they, for thousands of years, the people of the Korean Peninsula have been hunting whales, and they point to cave paintings along the south coast that depict a whale hunt. But a historian here in Seoul pointed out that whale hunting, consumption of whale meat, really didn't become that popular in Korea until about 100 years ago, late 19th century or so, when foreign whale hunters came from the United States or Europe and even Japan. And then during Japan's colonization of the Korean Peninsula in the early 20th century, that's when eating whale began to take off. And from an environmental activist I spoke with earlier today from Greenpeace Korea said that this city of Ulsan that has this heritage of whaling, these are all people that worked for Japanese fishing companies, and they were the ones who continued the practice of whale hunting until it was banned in the 1980s.
It's a political hot potato, this issue. I just wondered, with elections later in the year, this kind of thing, is it a political driver then behind this, or is there really a feeling that it's more important to regulate an industry which, as we touched upon before, is already taking place to a limited degree, or do you think there's a political agenda here?
Of course, this is an election year, and politicians from all ends of the political spectrum are pandering for votes. One of the leading contenders for that is soon to announce her bid for the presidency, Park Geun-hye, is from the region where that would benefit most from the lifting from this loophole in the moratorium of whaling that would allow hunting of whaling under the guise of scientific research to be done. And by allowing fishermen to hunt whale, politicians will be able to get votes from other people in the agriculture sector. Usually farmers tend to vote more toward the progressive camp here in South Korea. So I think the conservatives who are in power now are going to do anything they can to attract a few more votes from that segment of the population.
And then looking more globally in terms of the international political dimension, obviously whaling is a very contentious issue. And in Europe and a lot of the Western world, it would be seen as a electoral disaster to sort of even consider starting whaling again. Is there any fear, do you think, from within South Korea about what this development tells the world about South Korea, if you like? Is there a fear about the judgments that might be made from Western allies, for example?
South Koreans are very sensitive about how the outside world regards them. And if there was a lot of negative media attention in the foreign press, as well as some condemnation from other countries, it could sway public opinion. But Koreans, at the same time, are very defensive about their culture. And if people believe that whaling is an intrinsic part of their heritage, that it's, you know, it's something their ancestors did, if it's something that's, you know, connected to, you know, the most basics of their livelihood, they're going to be very defensive about that. And like we've seen in Japan to a certain extent, they're going to rally behind the idea of catching whales again. So it could go really either way. There's those who are very, very sensitive and want to put on a good face for the outside world. But, you know, sometimes that Koreans can really, backed into a corner, they can become very nationalistic about these cultural aspects.
We touched upon relationship with Japan slightly earlier, and I just wondered finally, do you think there's any subtext here about that, the fact that Japanese whaling continues unabated? Is there any political subtext with the relationship between those two nations? Is that a driver behind the South Koreans' wish to resume their whaling, or is that really not relevant, do you think, in this instance?
I think Korea, as it's developed more, it's gained more political, economic, as well as soft power, it feels that it can ask a little bit more in the international community. And I think the fact that Japan, who many people here still consider their rival, both economically, politically, even militarily, I think there is a sense that if Japan can do it, well, so can we. I think South Koreans want to be able to ask a little bit more, get its way more. I think there's a lot of people here who feel that they've been somewhat victim of different international norms and organizations and the IMF, whoever, and that now it's time, since they've reached a certain status of economic development, that they can start calling their own shots, if you will.
That was Jason Strother talking to Monocle's Tom Edwards. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett. In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll be leafing through the pages of the London Literature Festival and discussing the design of London's newest skyscraper. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Investigators probing the Air France Rio Paris crash that killed 228 people 3 years ago have blamed a combination of pilot error and faulty speed sensors. A news website says a general in the elite Syrian Republican Guards has defected to Turkey. WikiLeaks says it has begun publishing more than 2 million emails from Syrian government officials that would embarrass not only Damascus, which is trying to crush a 16-month rebellion, but also its opponents. A pair of trucks carrying NATO supplies have crossed into Afghanistan. It's the first time in more than 7 months that Pakistan has allowed Western nations to use its roads to supply troops in Afghanistan. The UN Security Council has endorsed West African political efforts to end unrest in Mali, but stopped short of backing military intervention in the West African state, where Al-Qaeda-linked militants control significant territory. A Florida judge has set bond at $1 million for George Zimmerman, the Florida Neighborhood Watch volunteer who shot and killed unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin. In London, British police have arrested six people suspected of preparing terrorist attacks, some of them from near the Olympic site. The European Central Bank cut interest rates to a record low today to breathe life into a deteriorating eurozone economy and back up measures agreed by government leaders last week to tackle the bloc's debt crisis. And Europe's highest building will be officially inaugurated later today with a laser and light show. The Shard, which is close to London Bridge, stands 310 metres high. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett. Coming up next, we'll be discussing the design of the Shard. But before that, this is a Midori House session from a couple of months back. Seagulls by the Wave Pictures. That was Seagulls by the Wave Pictures. The time is 18:37 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Now, today, London has been looking skyward as the Shard, Europe's tallest building, is unveiled. Rated by some as a sleek new shape on the skyline, others, such as UNESCO, claim that it's broken some perfect city vistas and dragged the eye away from the likes of the Tower of London and St Paul's Cathedral. And if its form wasn't controversial enough, its function has prompted questions too. The hotel and penthouses apart, only a third of the building is reportedly under negotiation to be let. A little earlier, Monocle's Emma Nelson, Hugo MacDonald, Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck sat down and discussed their take on the building.
Tyler, I'll start with you. The Shard will be open to the tune of Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, but this is about as far from common as you can get, isn't it?
Absolutely. When you look at this project, and also, you know, not all of it has been let, it's how it's going to define this area or not. And what's interesting is, and Hugo, you might be able to pick up on this as well, but the lack of density from a vertical perspective in that area. So it really sort of does cut through the landscape. And I think from a sales point of view, yes, you want to be a pioneer. You want to stand out. But I think also you want safety in numbers as well. And I think that's one of the slightly strange things. I think it will also be challenged from a hotel perspective. You have, of course, a lot of big companies, a lot of big corporates around there. So, Shangri-La does stand a very good chance, but I think they're going to have to market it very hard as well for hotel guests.
Andrew, the city boys have said that it's a bridge too far to move. How successful do you think it could be in terms of shaping that area of London?
I think that argument you have to be careful about that, because these pockets of kind of high rises can be successful for short term. We have an area on the south of London called Croydon, which actually was a boom town in the 50s, and when it was, skyscrapers, our version of a little mini Manhattan. And it was successful for a short period. And then obviously we now have Canary Wharf. So you do get these areas which aren't actually very central, where you can drag people to for a short time. But what happens is that when you put up so many new buildings all at the same time, it's then very hard to kind of slowly retrofit them, slowly change them. So unlike the City of London, which has had this kind of ability to adapt to the times, these one-off buildings, they have like amazing short bursts of really powerful life, and then they seem to kind of fade, I think.
Hugo, you pretty much live underneath it. How has that changed your experience of where you live?
Well, it's interesting, actually. I just moved back to the area, and I used to live there about 5 years ago before work had even started on the building. And every view that you have, every street that you walk down, you can see the Shard from now. And it really has sort of, I mean, this is what Renzo Piano's intention was to sort of punctuate the skyline with something very sharp that you can't really sort of get away without looking at. I actually like it. I've sort of lived with it as it's gone up, and everybody was horrified when it was just a big column of concrete. But now that it's sort of, people are used to it with the glass, people are getting used to seeing it from everywhere. It changes your perspective of the city.
Doesn't really quite fit.
It's very different to the buildings that you have even further north of the river in the city. It's different from Canary Wharf from the 80s. But it's sort of what it represents really in terms of money, money being back in London.
Andrew, it looks like only a third of the space has now been filled. What kind of image does that project of London on the global scale, that we've got this new building, but it's been built with foreign money? but it's not really a London creation and isn't really a representation of London.
Again, actually, I wouldn't be too worried about that. I was unfortunately one of the early tenants of Canary Wharf when it first opened, and we were in One Canada Square, which was, you know, the tallest building supposedly in Europe at that time. And it was a monstrous place, but they couldn't let it for love nor money. And in fact, I was working for a newspaper that was given a very cheap rent because they were just desperate to get someone on the floor. And sure enough, after 5 years, when the rents went up, they raised their rents and we moved on. So I'm sure that they'll begin to find tenants. But that building had many floors still empty many years later. And it took about 10 years just for that one building to fill up. But again, it's interesting you're talking about how it fits into the public realm, because I think Canary Wharf is an amazing example of how to get it wrong, because it rebuts every single person around it. It's a state within a state, and that's the problem with these tall buildings. They tend to repel as many people as they attract.
I think sort of the halo effect around it is actually quite good, whether you like the architecture or not. What it does is it does continue to position London, you know, as an international city.
And now joining us on the line is John Hitchcocks from You, the man behind more than 30 large-scale global property ventures. Hi, John.
Hello.
So thanks for joining me. What do you think the Shard means for London?
I'm in favour of tall buildings generally. I think the location is interesting because it's further regeneration south of the river, which is absolutely great. I mean, I remember many years ago being one of the first developers in Bankside and everybody saying this is never going to work, you're too far away from everything, and now that's all changed, and I think it's going to connect more of that whole of that southern strip of the river together. I mean, I agree with what Andrew's saying about Canary Wharf and certainly Croydon. I think this building's actually more central than both of those, and you have to be careful that they have an internal sort of they have an internal role. It's literally a vertical village in its own right, but it also has an external role as well, which people need to remember. I think the location of this being on top of London Bridge is fantastic for commuters, etc.
Well, London isn't known for its skyscrapers. Do you think this is going to have an impact on the way people think about our city, and how important do you think it is on a global scale?
I think when you've got a green belt and you've got one of the most successful, the most successful financial hub in the world, and one of the best city in the world, I think we're going to be forced up. You don't have, you know, if we are going to continue to be successful, we are going to be forced up. And it provides for much, much more. If you go to New York, there's much, much more street activity. There's much, much more vibrance and liveliness on the street because, I think, of these tall buildings, because it just
everyone's in the sky.
It increases the density of the population. So when they move around, you see them.
I mean, I think what's interesting about this, when people read about it and hear about it, is it's funded, the Shard's funded by Qatari money in Maine. Do you think this could have happened with British money, British investment?
I mean, I think the timing was just, you know, they were, I mean, Irvin Seller it's such a major project. He put his back into it, and he really, really he's pushed something out of the ground, and phenomenally. I mean, you know, they didn't have the site in the first place, had to do a deal on the land, had to do a deal in the sky, had to find the money in a time when there was virtually no banks around for speculative office projects. And, you know, it's interesting, the Qataris have funded a lot of very, very high-quality, bold projects around the world, and in a way you've got to take your hats off to them.
In terms of how they're going to fill it, because this has been the topic of much discussion, which do you think is going to be most successful? The office part, the hotel part, the residential part? Which one?
Well, the residential part's always much easier. The take-up of office space is much, much slower than residential. And also the demand for residential in London is so strong at the moment. I don't think one is necessarily going to be more successful than the other. It was interesting that they decided to put more offices, much more offices than residential in the project. I think, you know, the hotel is quite a challenging location, in as much as, you know, it's not an obvious place, and there aren't that many very high quality hotels in the city or in the city fringes. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how the market reacts to that. But it's So if I was to put those in a rank those, I'd probably go residential, office, hotel.
Okay. Well, we've forced your hand there. We'll see how your prediction does. But in terms,
It will be very difficult to measure that prediction.
Okay. We'll come back to it, I'm sure. But in terms of how you think the Shard is going to age, that's my big question. You know, how architecture looks.
Always challenging these tall buildings. I mean, if you go back to the 60s and look at how some of those buildings aged, you know, they were appalling. And now we've got an era over the last 10, 15 years where these buildings have been very beautifully finished and designed to last. I mean, I hope it does. It's fair. Renzo Piano is a very experienced, very, good architect. I think it's a very bold and stunning piece.
Okay, we'll have to catch it back up on that one and also how your predictions fared. So thank you very much indeed. That was John Hitchcock's From You. Now, you're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett, and we're going to head to the London Literature Festival next, so stay with us.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
All this week, we take a look at some sparkling startups in Greece, Portugal, Italy, Iceland and Spain who are bucking the trend and delivering profit amidst the gloom. From visionary olive oil manufacturers in Athens to canny film producers in Lisbon, we meet the entrepreneurs who are defying the odds and building great businesses. That's Businesses Beating the Odds, all this week on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett. This week sees the London South Bank Centre host the 6th annual Literature Festival, featuring headline names such as Andy Kershaw, Will Self, Stella Duffy and Mark Haddon. With a global array of writers, artists and activists from across Africa and the Arab region, and dispatches from Mumbai, China and the Caribbean, and poetry from top spoken word artists Saul Williams and Kate Tempest, the festival is arguably the UK's most dynamic literature festival.
The Literature Festival runs until the 12th of July. It's our intention to make this an urban-focused literature festival which deals with some of the big social and political issues of the day with key speakers talking on those subjects. So an example would be John Pilger, the great foreign correspondent and journalist who's with us next week on Tuesday, 10th of July. Clive Stafford Smith is being interviewed by Jon Snow the following evening on the Wednesday, and he's talking about his new book, Injustice. But it's much more than just about big name speakers. This weekend, we're hosting the UK's biggest ever poetry slam with lots of teams of young people coming down from all over the country, for a competitive series of events in the Purcell Room over the weekend. And headlining that weekend, we have the great Saul Williams with us in the QEH, who's going to be doing a show based on his poetry and spoken word.
And what is your main audience like?
Well, we try to be open to all the different audiences of London, all the different tribes of London. So people who are interested in graphic novels will come to our It's Dark in London event, which is based around a collection of graphic short stories by writers including Alexi Sale and Stella Duffy and Ian Sinclair. And then we appeal to a more political audience with events like John Pilger and Clive Stafford Smith. We're a venue for budding readers with our Story Slam event where people can deliver 5 minutes of the short story that they've written in front of a judging panel made up of publishers and editors. We're open to everyone from London. We don't see ourselves as having one audience, but, infinite audiences.
What has been your highlight so far, and what are you most looking forward to?
My highlight so far has been a reading we had yesterday evening with two Nigerian authors, Chika Onigwe and No Sarawiwa. They were basically talking about their novels and their relationship to Nigeria, which is the country that they come from. They're both Nigerian diaspora writers. And it was a fantastic discussion about the city of Lagos, one of the biggest cities in the world, one of the most dynamic cities of the world, and the relationship to the Nigerian literary heritage.
What sets the London Literature Festival apart from other literary festivals?
I think what makes it unique is its location. We're based in the heart of London, one of the most diverse and dynamic cities in the world. We have a spectacular modernist and brutalist site here, which is, of architectural distinction. We're not based in a small market town, or we don't set up camp in the middle of fields. We're an urban festival which people have to fit into their busy, daily lives in the capital.
Now, the London Literature Festival is being branded as one of the most dynamic in the UK. How do you keep the diversity so varied?
I think we keep the diversity varied by using the different art forms that we have at South Bank Centre and continually working with other art form programmers here, using the spaces that we have, the backdrop, if you like. I think that's one of the things, but also just the sheer diversity of London itself. It's always throwing up new inspirations, new problems, new things that society needs to respond to, and we try to do that through our programming.
How long have you been involved with the London Literature Festival?
I've been involved with the London Literature Festival since its inception, which is in 2007. The festival was part of our reopening summer when the festival hall was reopened following a period of refurbishment. So, when the artistic director, Jude Kelly, came on board, she saw the summer 2007 as a big moment in our history, and the London Literature Festival responded to that. Previously, there hadn't been literature festivals in London which had been successful and had continued year on year, and we thought it was time to change that, and we believe we have with the London Literature Festival.
That was Martin Colthorpe, programmer at the London Literature Festival. You're listening to Midori House. Now, to finish today's show, we turn to Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, who ponders whether new cities that are built from scratch can ever feel soulful without a sense of history.
I was born in the 1960s. My dad was 50. So the London he told me about living in as a young man may seem dusty and distant to you. In his 20s, for example, he commuted to work in London's Holborn by train and tram, the latter a type of transport, like my dad, long since vanished from London's streets. Today, by some nice coincidence, I live in Holborn, an area of the city that sits between the busy, shop-packed neighbourhood of Covent Garden and the Inns of Court, home for centuries to the country's leading legal folk. One of the odder landmarks in Holborn is the cobblestone exit from a subterranean tunnel. Its black metal gates are padlocked shut. Look through the gates, however, and you can see a ghostly echo of a lost world, the rusted rails that once carried the Holborn trams. Is this where my dad would have jumped off as the tram popped up out of the tunnel and back into the sunlight? This entrance to a lost world is a red dot on my map of London, a place that catches me as others dash past. Like most people who find their veins entwining with their city streets, my map of London cannot be found on a sat-nav or by turning the page of an A to Z. My London map is personal, a map made up of the places where things happen to me or people important to me. Take the Underground, literally and figuratively. I was on the tube with a friend, and we realised that, as long-term Londoners, every stop had a meaning, a reference not hinted at by simple place names. My version of the Piccadilly line had us rattling through clumsy date, missed opportunity, Polish dinners, bad trousers, rainy Sunday, first job, flat hunt and book pitch. Perhaps it should have been a jolting journey in some ways, but these flashbacks are what makes a city and your memory bank fuse together. That's how we see cities. They are our histories in bricks and mortar, and you can't redraw them. You can understand why some people flee and some people are drawn back to the same places again and again. It's because the best cities offer us places not just to work, play and sleep, but for our lives to unfold in unexpected and colourful ways. But here's the rub. Can you manufacture the ingredients you need for the maps to appear? It's not enough to have tall towers or smart communication systems. It doesn't help if your city is carbon neutral or has its own app. Without history, without layers, serendipity, without the chance of remembering where your dad once got off the bus, can a city have a soul? We are in an epic rush to urbanisation, and all sorts of people are putting up their hands to create cities from scratch, from Saudi Arabia to China. One of these men is Ajit Gulabchand, chairman of the Hindustan Construction Company. In the hills near Pune, he's erecting Lavasa, a hill station that looks a bit like Portofino. He wants his town to grow to be a city and offer a new template for how to urbanise India. He's warm and positive, but he says that he has some sleepless nights. The cause isn't the cost of cement or whether the units will sell. He frets that the master plan may not have catered for the soul, and he won't know until it's built and the city runs away from him, stops being a prim and ordered model. He'll have to hold his breath. At least Gulabchand dreams. Too many cities from scratch planners pretend to care about such things, but really don't. They are throwing up perfect technopolises with gleaming metro stations, but they are ones that I fear will never get renamed Proposal Point or Love at First Sight in anyone's mental map. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Tuck.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Alex Jakes. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Urbanist. Today we learn about Olympic legacies.
I'm sure that in 50 years it's just going to feel great, like a really good bit of East London. And it's coming back in 10 years that I'm more curious to see how it's going to feel then.
In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Chloe Potter and Andrew Muller will be back for the Monocle Daily, where they'll be discussing the government crackdown on the protests in Angola and much, much more. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening to me, Emma Barnett. Goodbye.